Okay. I think we can start the second session of today. So I think that based on the previous experience, perhaps it's better to have the questions at the end of the session. Or do you agree, Olli-Pekka? So that
Yeah,
we
if there's no any urgent questions or comments at right now.
And you can use the chat, write the questions there, and then we will reserve something like 5 minutes from the end for answering the questions, and then you can raise also your hand there. But okay, so let's continue. I'm recording this now, and I'll switch off my own video. So please, Olli-Pekka, continue.
Okay, thanks, Juha-Pekka, and welcome to this second 2 45-minute sessions on my Quest lecture. And as you know, it's about financial innovation, fintech, and shadow banking. And we started our joint travel together by talking how is it possible that although in the kind of pure theory there's no need for banks or financial intermediation, such things exist in the real world, and what are the functions these financial intermediaries do in the economy. We discussed about the aspects of human behavior and about the various informational asymmetries that give a rise to a need of such organizations as a kind of solutions to these problems and to kind of help the exchanges, financial transactions in the world. Then we talked a little bit about banking and especially about the competitiveness, the competitive questions in regards to the stability of the financial sector, about the risk-taking and how it could be mitigated. And from those banks, we went back, we enlarged the scope to shadow banks, a new phenomena in a sense that at least the name is new, although some of those organizations that now are classified to shadow banks have been there for quite a long time. And the interesting for these shadow banks and that sector was given birth by the bad experiences during the financial crisis of 2008. And from there, we talked a little bit about the organizational forms, about the cooperative, shareholder-owned financial sector companies and entities, and about how that could kind of like also have an effect. And now we are actually going to this financial innovation, and we kind of stopped our last session on the few notes. What does this innovation do in finance? What is its purpose? And as we started the lecture from the Merton's notes of what financial intermediation is supposed to do, then we kind of concluded that this is actually that the innovation tries to look at each of these categories and make them somehow more efficient or increase the flow of information to kind of minimize transaction costs, to enable technology to kind of harness the effectiveness of these different kind of aspects of financial sector. So that's where we are going, and we're going to look a little bit more about financial innovation first, and then we go to fintech, which, as I said, is the kind of now the buzzword for this financial innovation. It is kind of the form that most of the change and disruption in the financial sector is taking place. And from that, we are going to then actually talk about regulation. And we're going to end our joint trip together, our joint journey, by actually looking at the regulation of innovation in financial services sector, and also what is the kind of special challenges for regulation that is evident now, and how the kind of regulatory authorities have responded to it. When I was giving these lectures in Vaasa, and also I have given these in Hanken. This was in the before the summer, and a lot of things were discussed about why in these lectures the regulation is highlighted, why is the discussion so much putting emphasis on regulation, and at that time there wasn't not that many kind of like fintech crises that have now actually hit the market. The most noteworthy is, of course, the Wirecard, the German, the most like finest and the prime example of fintech revolution. That was actually a scam, in a sense that billions of money were hoaxed within that company and everything, and it has really kind of disrupted the fintech movement in a sense that it has highlighted the risks involved. And therefore, I think that now on the hindsight, I think this regulation is important aspect, and we should kind of use some time to kind of look at it more clearly, because although the financial innovation and fintech promises a lot of like more surplus to consumers, more ease of doing their transactions and such, there is this risks of losing the money, and that is something that has to be in the kind of regulators' top agenda. So that's kind of like the background, and we can then ask that, you know, if there is such a kind of like emergence of innovation and fintech type of firms within this kind of financial intermediation, why is it now? Why has it started like in after 2010? The reasons given for this emergence of this new innovation is that if you look at the financial services sector, all the products are basically digital. We saw the value chain in banking on the slide, and you can see that actually there is very little tangible stuff besides like ICT. There is like the it's a flow of information. It's connecting the dots. It's information that can be turned very easily in a digital form, and therefore, you know, not only are these products basically as they are contracts easily digital, also the distribution and services upon these products can be digitalized, and because they can be digitalized, you know, it can be very cost efficient to do such thing, and that's why there is have been a huge push to kind of transform financial sector firms, financial intermediaries into the kind of digital counterparts. There's also that this kind of digitalization has gone through in other industries, the customers are kind of now willing to experiment or use these same types of interactions even in the kind of when they are doing their financial affairs. And as we saw and we will be seeing, many of these emerging competitors actually come to a market with their digital offerings because it is such much more efficient and much more easy to come with the digital offerings. However, when we look at this sector from the Finnish perspective, one should remember that Finnish financial sector industry is actually quite advanced that if we look, for example, the banking sector in United States or in Southern Europe, or not to say in the some of the emergent markets, there is like a lot of space to be catched in order for those banks and financial intermediaries to catch up with the kind of the Finnish financial sector industry. And this actually is also apparent in the studies where the efficiency of banks, for example, are measured. It is usually the case that Nordic countries rank very high on those surveys and like efficiency studies. But this actually is about to change. We will see in the later slides that most of this innovation is actually at the moment happening in Asia, in China especially. Therefore, it seems that part of this disruption also is that at some of these emergent markets will bypass some of the stages that in a kind of economic historical view was traveled by the industry. So we will see that there is this legacy in let's say United States, Southern Europe, but there is a huge move and a lot of new innovation happening in Asia. So things are changing rapidly there. But although there is this push, one could argue that we just saw that because of the nature of the financial services, financial intermediation, which is about the information, it's about the kind of contracts, and can be easily digitalized, and therefore the change could be very rapid. There is some parts of the kind of like some characteristics of the industry that makes the innovation difficult, and I have highlighted here some. It is actually a quite conservative industry, although there is this kind of like now the heightened awareness of fintech and everything. But basically, when you look at the attitudes of the people, of the consumer, if you look at the kind of money related and finance related issues, it's usually shown that people are very risk averse and very conservative, and therefore they have the kind of preponderance of not experimenting as much and avoiding kind of risks. And therefore, these new innovations sometimes take time to catch up or to kind of be adapted. Then there is the other thing is that because of this this nature of financial products, which are basically contracts, the protection of this intellectual property within financial sector is very difficult. It's very easy to copy an innovation, and therefore, because of the innovation is easily copied, there is less incentives for the firms to kind of really do a lot of kind of research and development, because if you come up with something new that is kind of like adopted, it's probably be soon copied by your competitors. This was something that was actually in early 2000, there was a change in patent laws in United States, which enlarged the scope of patents also to have like business model type of innovations. And very rapidly, a lot of these kind of banking and finance related service models, business models, ways of calculating things, although the mathematical kind of formulas cannot be patented, was being filed in the United States. And this actually caused a lot of kind of confusion in the market. And nowadays, they have actually kind of a little bit drawn back from this. So there was this attempt in the kind of the first kind of like phase of this kind of digital innovation, try to somehow kind of be able to patent, to have a kind of intellectual property rights defined. But that turned out to be more difficult than expected, and more kind of confusion prone. So there has been a kind of like a withdrawal in a sense from that a bit. But there's also stuff happening still there, in a sense that this is also something that, of course, the kind of legal profession tries to kind of like dwell and make rules in order to kind of enforce them. We've talked about the basic risk avoiding nature of the industry. Then there is this regulation, and we will come back to regulation. But however, the regulation kind of, I'll tell you a little bit how it has kind of opened up in last years and being more kind of positive towards innovative activities within financial service industry. The regulation still is also like very conservative, very kind of risk avoiding, and it could be said that it hinders innovation. Then there is the maturity of the market, in a sense that if we look at the kind of basic building blocks, which are kind of deposits, which are kind of loans, which are kind of securities and stuff, there is the maturity that there is actually not a very much room, I would argue, to the kind of like really kind of to have those niches. And we will see actually in the fintech lecture that if we look at this from the kind of industrial organization perspective and the perspective of like research and development activities, one could argue that these fintech firms are actually mainly outsourced research and development, but that's just one of my arguments, which I will come back to. And then if we look, for example, risk and insurance as a part of the financial sector, then there is this limit that have to be met, and it's very difficult to kind of have a kind of very innovative products in that scope. Because the limits and the requirements for making something insurable is limited. Then there is this lack of demand, perhaps because of the cost, but also a lack of financial literacy. People have to kind of learn to use the products and know their kind of like size. And if people are not very financial literate, they tend to be also more conservative. There is still data limitations, and now, like for example, the general these privacy laws that kind of hinder the possibility of using data to the extent that would be required to really kind of, for example, evaluate risks, credit risk, and such. These data protection laws also have an impact on the possibility to innovate new products. And of course, this is asymmetric information, and then there is basis risk, which is kind of like also very, very important features. If we look at the kind of like innovation typology, what could be, we kind of often think that innovation is something that is kind of like really, path breaking in, you know, totally disrupting the industry, and really kind of something mind blowingly new. But most of the innovation, if you look at the kind of the literature, is this kind of incremental, very kind of like changing just some of the features, more kind of small scale experimental than like really transformationally innovative and disruptive. And this is actually quite a good, I think, kind of for column, in a sense that here we cannot talk about kind of like modest technical change, significant technical change, and also kind of, is it happening in the existing markets or new markets? How is it? Is it incremental or transformational? And one thing that I also want to highlight here is this idea that this can be also innovation that is sustaining, which is like you innovate to kind of defend your position in the market. You defend to kind of like not to kind of expand in a transformational, disruptive new market sense, but kind of like trying to kind of keep up and tie your current customer base into your kind of like sense. So the sustaining innovation is also a very important part of this typology. We are going to talk about fintech firms, and one could argue that there is this grounds where the new competitors are kind of coming to the financial services sector. And one of the reasons, of course, is, as I talked about the conservativeness and everything, is that the sector has been quite a poor innovator. I think it's Paul Volcker who said that the only innovation that banks have done in the last 50 years is like an automatic teller machine. There hasn't been a great push to innovate. One of the reasons also that I already mentioned was that also the regulatory authorities have been very lukewarm to innovation by financial services. There has been, there used to be a pre-screening of the products. There was a very tight regulatory regime that left very much, very little room for innovation. The features, if we look at these new competitors, for example, the fintech firms, is that if you look at the value chain, we looked in the first part of the lecture, these new competitors focus on very, very narrow range. So of all these activities, like a universal bank offers, these new competitors are targeting just the most profitable and the most kind of narrow range offerings. This is, of course, also because they are not as big as in size, so they have to kind of come with the narrow range in the offering. But it's also that you try to kind of get the customer to have a good experience in a narrow range of these kind of products or offerings. Then as these new competitors usually are digital, then there is this strong economies of scale that are apparent. They are usually cloud-based. They are very lean. The new competitors have not only, I have discussed mainly about the fintech firms, but of course, there is the digital giants like this. So constantly talk about Facebook. And as you know, Facebook had this currency experiment. There is like the in insurance, for example, there is this threat of Google kind of entering the insurance space, and they even tried with the car insurance portal, which they then actually killed. But there is this digital giants that could possibly come to the field, and especially in China, this has happened. You have the Alipay, Alibaba, Tencent. All these are moving in, not only in the kind of pay. They started with the payment, payments, but they have expanded into the loans, into the insurance, all this, and that has kind of like caused. We pay to be mentioned also a kind of disruption in there, and of course there's traditional companies who are actually trying to become digital. That's something that is apparent in the Finnish financial sector, services and with Vario's success, and so these startups, these digital giants, and these traditional companies pose a potential threat. There's this World Economic Forum that convenes in, actually resides in Switzerland, and they actually have this Davos meeting. They run those also, and they published a survey on the kind of like financial innovation landscape. And I think there is like a number of items that can be taken there. They have kind of concluded that we can actually study this innovation because it's deliberate, and you can actually start kind of predicting which are the kind of areas where most of the activity is going to happen. And they actually conclude that these existing players will be kind of targeted from the challengers where there's like the biggest kind of customer unhappiness and biggest kind of possibility for profits. And the WEF researchers also kind of suggest that the biggest impact will be kind of platform-based, data-intensive, and capital-light business models. And these are actually business models that especially these kind of Chinese big kind of... electric retail platforms have adopted. They say that in when they wrote this report, I think it was 2012, the prediction was that actually the banking sector will be disrupted first, and this was because there was this, for example, in Europe there was the directive to open the payment data for third parties, which is now in force, but when they looked at the different kind of how the digitalization has affected the products, they concluded that the greatest impact would be in the insurance sector, but that would take a long time. Very interesting view that they had was that it's not going to be just competition, it's going to be also about cooperation. And if we look at the situation now in 2020, we can actually conclude that there is more and more cooperation happening instead of like direct competition. And one of the kind of arguments I have is that actually the old financial sector players have adjusted themselves quite successfully to this emergence of these kind of especially technology-led fintech firms. And I'll argue more about it later. Although things seem to happen quickly, this disruption will be a long process. They also kind of, in their survey, concluded different areas and what would be the kind of the main areas of change and innovation. And I think this is also a kind of good to go through to just to give you an idea how in how many different areas things are actually changing. And if we kind of like go to the most evident and maybe something that you have encountered kind of like in your day-to-day financial sector transactions is this payment system changes where you have a kind of like cashless mobile payments. There is a mobile money, there is the transfer, immediate transfer from one account to another. There is a possibility to send directly money. There is this peer-to-peer kind of transferal services. There is cryptocurrency. I'll talk a little bit more about that. Of course, this blockchain-based cryptocurrencies are kind of like in a lot of discussion. But then there is these other areas also that one should not forget. Well, if you go directly to the opposite side, of course, the crowdfunding is something that has been talked a lot, and there's different types of crowdfunding platforms. There is kind of like lending platforms. There is a kind of voluntary gift type of platforms like Mecenate in Finland. And there is all kinds of development going on there with smart contracts, with the kind of different types of crowdfunding possibilities. However, this crowdfunding is also one of the areas that has been now been hit by kind of like crises. As I mentioned, there is a big UK and American-based crowdfunding platforms that have had issues with kind of loan payback, with kind of getting the products that the people have financed and such. So there is a kind of like area of where the enthusiasm has gone away and the reality has hit, and a lot of regulatory activity is now happening in this crowdfunding space. In Finland, of course, there is already kind of like regulatory activity in that part and like that. Well, then if we go to deposits and lending, there is, of course, this alternative lending sites. And then there is other kind of third party development. There is digital players taking care of lending. There's payday lenders and those that are there in that quadrant. But also this kind of investment management has seen influx of new kind of offerings, and there's although I talk about fintech, this has actually been broken down on different subparts. So one of the areas has been defined as a part of fintech is this kind of wealth tech, which would be this kind of investment management helped by AI and big data and software. And then actually there is one part of fintech is this insurtech, which actually has to do with the insurance. And there you have, even in Finland, you have different kind of new players. Fair is one example. There is like friends insurance, and the possibility to measure and to monitor different physical things through the kind of Internet of Things type of stuff, or measure the actual movement of vehicles, and you know, to have yourself monitored by your phone, your watch, digital watch, makes it possible to kind of develop new products and to price old offerings, to take care, for example, to take kind of into account your driving habits, your health status and stuff like that. So there's a lot of things happening with kind of like trying to find more data which then could be used to underwrite these new offerings. And then there's this market provisioning, which is of course mostly about artificial intelligence, machine learning, new market platform. But that just gives you an idea that there's like almost all aspects of financial intermediation, financial services is kind of being some one way or another looked at, although maybe not disrupted at the moment very far in a very great extent, but a lot of activities happening in that space. So we go then to fintech, and the fintech is one could say that it's kind of like the business model type of approach to kind of financial innovation. It has the kind of three key forces behind it. It's this technology innovation, it's about the process, and it's about the services transformation. And we already saw in the previous slide about the fields that are in this WEF map that has been looked at. So if we go more directly to where the fintech is actually kind of like hitting is, as I mentioned, the payments and money. There is the insurance part. Then the RegTech we didn't touch yet so much, but there's also a subgroup of fintech firms called RegTech, which is attempt to kind of make it easier for the financial service companies to fulfill the requirements of regulation, you know, the information requirements and other. But also there is this kind of RegTech, which kind of maybe a little bit tries to make it easier for to avoid the regulation. And then there is activities concerned with kind of mortgages and real estate, and then, you know, these kind of platforms. There is the European Banking Association made a study in 2017 about the major areas. So maybe I just highlight the few that I haven't yet touched on. There is this kind of robo advice, automatic advice based on the kind of market data. There is the kind of smart contracts, which are kind of electronic contracts based on this kind of blockchain technology that makes it possible to kind of verify, for example, financial transactions without the need of kind of central kind of verification site. And I also mentioned this RegTech, which is the kind of using new technology to enhance regulatory process. But this is kind of like the space we are talking. And if the banks are not able to kind of either to counter these or then to kind of build alliances or adapt these new technologies, of course they will run into the difficulties. There is a possibility even to kind of like some of these technologies like the blockchain to really fundamentally kind of change the way the kind of financial intermediation is done. As I said, it's a kind of distributed technology, which kind of makes it redundant to use a kind of these type of verification institutions to kind of verify whether a contract has been signed or endorsed. And the response that the banks have done for this kind of threat is that they have actually built up consortiums where they try to either build their own blockchain technologies and to kind of leverage those and then try to kind of like to get the systems that they can kind of like leverage in themselves. There's just to kind of give you an idea more of the areas, and maybe you know some of these companies that have been emerged, but there is this Venture Scanner, which is a kind of a consulting group that clearly tracks and monitors the space. So we have in this breaking up of different parts, some of the biggest fintech type of firms, and you can maybe you have, especially in the crowdfunding, maybe you have heard about Kickstarter or Indiegogo. There is other kind of like Klarna there in the payments backend, which is a Swedish company that if you have bought in Adlibris or somewhere, you definitely have come across that. And then there is those that are active in a kind of startup scene. There is this kind of Seeders and Circle and Karta, which help you in your kind of equity financing. So there is a lot of and one of other clear sign about the that there is activity going on in this area is of course that how much funding is directed to finance these new companies. And this is also from the Venture Scanner report, where you can see that there is up to like 2018, there was really a big increase on the funding. We are talking about like 40 billion per year. But then we don't have a data about 2020, and there just came a McKinsey report saying that actually, especially in Europe, because of the COVID crisis, the funding has virtually dried up. So it could be that this COVID actually has made it very difficult to finance these fintech companies, and it might be the case that there is a kind of like plateau now on these new attempts. This is actually a thing that one should remember. We talk about an enormous amount of money being directed to kind of finance startups, and in this case, financing fintech startups, and then they, you know, the argument is, as I said, that there is like $40 billion being directed like in 2019 to this activity, and cumulative we are talking about hundreds of billions. But the thing that one has to keep in mind is we have no idea how much actually is funding has been done by banks and financial intermediaries and financial services companies in the research and development themselves. So we don't actually know where to compare these figures. So it might be that, you know, if the banks and other financial sector players have actually started to kind of do their own research and development to a larger extent, then it could be that these figures might turn out to be quite low. However, I have not come across a worldwide figure of kind of research and development or in the kind of financial sector services in the world. So we really don't know, is this a lot or is this just a little? But it's still sizable, and therefore one could expect that if you pour money into a research and development and product development, something useful should come out. And so there is this activity. Although, also, I want to come back to this geographical dispersion of activity across the globe. And as I mentioned already, that most of the activity is happening in Asia. This Cambridge University, they have the Center for Alternative Finance. They published 2 years ago, it's not 2018, it's actually 2020, because this is the 2019 hubs, or then it's vice versa. I'm sorry, I might have these years upside down. However, they surveyed the Center for Alternative Finance, where is this fintech activity happening in the world? And they had a number. This was, of course, in a sense, not only quantitative, but also qualitative, measurement. So you can't, of course, you can argue that maybe they kind of emphasized different aspects that are not really relevant. But there is some conclusions that can be drawn from this picture, and one is that actually if you look at the biggest ones, the Beijing, Shanghai, Hangzhou, Shenzhen are among, and even Hong Kong here are among the 10 biggest. So half of them are in China. There's San Francisco and New York. But then, and London, and those are actually the only kind of really prominent ones in the Western world. One could also kind of point out that Helsinki is nowhere to be seen here. It doesn't rank. Vilnius, for example, ranks in Stockholm, and Stockholm is even considered among the 20 largest ones. but the activity definitely is in Asia and preponderantly in China. So that's kind of like the global view of the development efforts in fintech and where they are situated, according to this Cambridge University Center for Alternative Finance. If you are interested on the subject matter, there's actually a very good vast repository of material and reports in that website also. So you could kind of visit that. We go now to kind of a few of the kind of hotspots of this fintech development and I already actually covered this crowdfunding, but just to kind of to visualize how different types of platforms there exist, there is this kind of equity peer-to-peer lending sites, but biggest crowdfunding is not actually about financial services. It's about kind of pre-sale, which means that there is a kind of a offering of products that the consumers can kind of order in advance, and they are kind of like marketing research tools more than kind of financing sites. The regulation is moving quite rapidly in this area, especially because of these kind of peer-to-peer lending and equity problems I mentioned in the UK and United States. So the consumer investor protection is rapidly arising here. And especially if you look at the peer-to-peer lending platforms, the problems here are that you know these are unsecured and there's no government guarantees, and you know it's sometimes it's very hard to kind of in these lending platforms the portfolios are broken sometimes into pieces and recombined to kind of diversify the risks, and they are not really very transparent. I talked about the blockchain as a kind of major possibility to kind of to really disrupt the industry, and the blockchain has a kind of two aspects. It's the aspect of cryptocurrencies and the way of kind of paying and transferring value and paying for different products in that space. And there's a lot of different cryptocurrencies being introduced. As you know, there is a wide fluctuation in the value. And I understood you had a lecture about the kind of this kind of cryptocurrencies by one of the colleagues in Vaasa. And this is actually something that is from economics viewpoint research a lot, because there is data available about the values and changes and the transactions. So it's actually the area where most of the kind of economic related research is conducted at the moment, especially in the kind of Bitcoin and but there is the other aspect which I think is more kind of impactful if we look at the industry, and this is the ledger side of it, which is this distributed ledgers technologies, which is the technology behind the blockchain. And as I mentioned, a lot of banks have and insurance companies and other financial sector companies have built up consortiums, and they are trying to kind of develop their in-house blockchain technologies, and they see that this is actually a possibility to really have a major cost efficiencies on the kind of production side. One thing that is often forgotten when they talk about the cryptocurrencies and these distribution ledger technologies is that it is often said that it's kind of like very transformative, but there is a number of technology-related problems that make it probable that it won't be adopted in as fast pace as has been the most optimistic kind of evaluations have said, and this is because it actually takes a lot of time to verify transaction. As you know, in this kind of blockchain, you record these transactions, and then they have to be kind of verified. Yeah, so this block has to be kind of like verified and sealed, and then there comes another block, and then you can kind of go back and kind of verify the transaction. However, this is extremely energy intensive, and because it requires a lot of calculations, and it's basically quite slow because of this. So if you kind of compare it like to the speed that that like Visa and MasterCard and other kind of payment processors can achieve, this kind of blockchain technology at the moment is nowhere near the speed required that it would be kind of like adopted in a wide use. And then there is the other problem is that it's not kind of hacking proof. So there has been problems where these kind of blockchain based, for example, smart contracts like Ethereum and various others you might have heard about have been actually hacked. So there is still this kind of underlying uncertainty on how efficient and how kind of risk-proof these technologies are. Interestingly, also the kind of many central banks have started to kind of look into the distributed ledger technologies. For example, Bank of Sweden has pilots, and there is even a kind of said aim in Bank of China that the whole country will become digital, and one way or another, it's going to be based on this kind of like this kind of technologies, the digital money. So there is interest in the central banks, but it's kind of still a bit hesitant. There are few slides here about like kind of what could be kind of the strategies that these incumbents could adopt vis-a-vis, for example, big tech companies. And then there is a kind of also similar ones about, wait a minute, about incumbent towards fintech firms, but I see that actually we have half an hour time, so I'm going to start going a little bit faster. We have here another kind of like view where you look at the customer experience and also this kind of market and competition based view of the of these offerings. And we talked about the Swiss research four quadrant area. It's kind of similar here where you have the disruptive and kind of complementary would be kind of supplementary or kind of not transformative type of activity there. And then the customer experience and there's kind of how you supplement or you enhance and how that kind of interaction can be looked at. One of the recent reports tried to also kind of typologize the fintech firms to different categories. And there you had this kind of the same as we talked earlier. So you have the kind of pure play fintechs, then you have the incumbent service providers, the existing banks and insurance companies that are trying to kind of harness these competencies and to move into the kind of new competencies, and then the technology providers, which were the big players. And if you look at the kind of advantages and disadvantages between these banks, fintechs, and big tech, there is a kind of a good outline from SEPR, where you have this that actually all of these have certain advantages that others are lacking. So in that sense, it's not a kind of clear cut that it is the big tech firms, for example, that will take over the banking sector or all that fintech small agile fintech firms will kind of replace big banks. I would say that there is a kind of like hybrid coexistence of these different entities even in the future. And there is some, you can see also here is another characterization about the advantages and disadvantages between fintechs and banks. There is actually a lot of collaboration happening in the moment, and this is the part I want to kind of further my argument that there has been an evolution in the way fintech firms and financial service firms have started to behave towards one and another. And I remember when this fintech revolution actually started, when I was in 2010 in University of Tampere, we were starting to look at this financial innovation, and there was no word like fintech at the moment. There was this understanding that digitalization will actually change the bank's operating environment and the competitive situation. But there was not the kind of understanding where this thrust would come, this change. And then it became apparent that it's technology based, and it will have this form of fintech type of startups starting to challenge. And then there was this fear of these big tech firms coming into to a play. What was the reaction of the established banks and insurance companies and for other financial sector players was that from the first shock that these fintech firms will come and disrupt their business models and take their customers, there came the understanding that, hey, that, you know, actually this is a very good way to outsource research and development. As we saw earlier, and if we look at the more economics-prone literature before in the start of these lectures, we saw that the kind of the offering the way they the financial sector firms have traditionally been very kind of conservative and not being very forthcoming in their research and development, partly because of the regulation. The company saw this as a possibility to outsource these to fintech firms. And now there has emerged these collaborational patterns I find very interesting. And I think this will be a kind of a way forward for quite some time. And this is that actually these big banks and other financial sector providers started to offer, promising startups, acceleration spaces, funding, all this kind of like incentives to develop products. By this, they were very clever that they had a huge amount of these small, lean teams of gifted coders and sector specific experts trying to come up with the new kind of like innovations, and these banks just gave them a space, a hub or acceleration or some kind of small funding, and actually this research and development that would have cost them a lot would have also had to be internalized the costs of failure, were now kind of put on the open innovation space. And these banks have now very aggressively developed ways of evaluating different fintech firms. And actually, if there is an innovation that they think that is useful, they will just buy this fintech or kind of incorporate it in some other way to their offering. So this is not as much, about fintechs challenging the incumbents, but more of like a procedure for these incumbents, these old firms, to outsource the research and development, make it very cost efficiently, and to kind of be able to buy in the expertise then of those fintech firms that have turned out to be promising. So I think this is something that was not apparent at first, but we see this, for example, in Finland. We have here a kind of like examples of this collaboration. So we have like Nordea, Osuuspankki Danske, we have If and LähiTapiola as insurance companies, and they have all this kind of, you know, Nordea has this Nordea Ventures, OP has, you know, Innovation Lab, they have these scouting teams, then they work together with the small fintech firms in Maria 01 here in Helsinki. Maybe there is some kind of space even in Jyväskylä or Oulu. They must have, there is actually OP had in Oulu, this kind of laboratory, Juha-Pekka knows. And then there is this kind of like collaboration projects and direct investments that these companies actually use. So there is less of this kind of disruption, more of kind of research and development in this fintech space. And I think this is also an example of a big kind of fuss and excitement that this kind of like finance and innovation promised. There was this idea that now all these kind of old banks will disappear, that there will be a kind of a big kind of change in the way people do their financial transactions. And now that the kind of dust has settled, there is activities, but they have been kind of more put on the service of these old players. This, of course, doesn't have to do with the kind of big tech players like Alibaba, WePay, everything that are clearly challenging the established banks and insurance companies and technologies, especially with their insurance arm. But this kind of like sudden disruption and change of the landscape has not materialized. I just had a few slides here because the fintech is not just about the banks and it also incorporates insurance. So there's some notes about how the kind of insurance business differs from bank. What are its kind of like constituent areas? So that's just for you. I'm not going to dwell more onto that. But if you are interested, you should definitely look at this. And then there is this kind of like uptake for fintechs, what to do, how to kind of respond to these different challenges. And I have same with this kind of insurtechs also, but because of the time, I don't want to go there kind of in more depths, but I would like to kind of go to the regulatory part. And this has two parts. It has the regulation actually of banking sector in total, then about the regulation of kind of financial innovation and the regulation of fintech. So that's a kind of like the straight jacket that the industry is. And to just give you an idea how this kind of, what role this plays in this financial innovation, in this fintech and shadow banking, it's important to go over this before the lectures end. So there is this kind of rationality that financial service firms should be regulated. And actually, the three most regulated industries in the world are, you might know, is medical industry. So all the drugs and this kind of medical offerings. The second one is food. So all food industry is heavily regulated. And the third one is this finance services industry. So those are the three most regulated industries in the world. And it just kind of gives you an idea that it's about your health, it's about what you put on your mouth and where you put your money in. The financial services have these systemic kind of effects that actually make it quite risk prone. Usually the leverage ratios are huge if compared with the normal kind of industries. You know that the kind of manufacturing firm might have a own capital, usually about 50%, but in financial services sector before the new regulation, it could be as low as 2%. So they were highly leveraged. There was possibility for even increasing the risks by making these financial transactions really risk loaded. It was very actually difficult to assess the quality of the capital required and the characteristics of different financial instruments. And then there was, of course, this possibility of systemic events causing a collapse of a whole industry. One of the also kind of important features was and still is that some of these global banks are huge, so they are many times their assets are many times the GDP of the countries they have their headquarters, so they are like too big to fail, in a sense that they really have this systemic risk components in them. Well, there's also the question that should these banks be regulated? I just told you about the rationality for regulation, but there is also a discussion that why should they be regulated? Like, you know, it costs a lot. There's an estimate that just the Basel cost about 3.5% in USA, and these are just direct regulatory costs. Then there's all kinds of setup costs, compliance costs that have to be bare, and they actually increase the cost of financial transactions. It might be that even if they are regulated, the risks that turn up to be black swans coming out of like unexpected areas that the regulation can't have no way making it impossible for the financial crisis to appear. There's also this discussion which we had already that this regulation decreases innovation therefore, it might be determinant for the kind of the growth of productivity in the industry, we'll actually end up with this question: that should government own banks? Should we have banks that are independent entities? And this actually has now become more acute, this question with COVID, where actually the central banks are doing a lot of things that are supposed to be done by banks themselves. So the central bank is actually directly kind of buying securities and pay loan papers from the companies and interacting in the market. So then we could actually ask, you know, why is there banks? Why can't just central bank do all this stuff as they are doing now with the COVID crisis? Or this is a little bit kind of like maybe a kind of a contestable. You can say things against this, but I think that's a kind of like a good thing to think that, you know, is there actually, we knew from the we started from that there is no need for banks. Now we are in a COVID situation where, you know, banks are kind of sidelined. So, you know, that's a kind of like thing to think. In this Frakes and Rochette book, there's a very nice kind of flowchart about the kind of framework which starts from these market failures and then, you know, what is the kind of regulatory agency incentives and how this kind of like, you know, strategic behavior competition and all these constraints then turn out to result a certain kind of equilibrium, and what is the role of kind of the regulation in this. And one good kind of highlight that the financial system regulation has different areas, and we talked about this deposit insurance, but there's of course these restrictions on entry. Not just anybody can come and set up a bank. There is a fit and proper requirements. You have to be a kind of, you have to have a work experience in banking. You have to be in good reputation. You can't have criminal record, of course, and all this. There is this minimum capital requirements, which are not very small. There is restrictions on assets and activities. And of course, there is this risk-based capital requirements that put a heavy burden on the financial system. So the regulation is many-faced and very detailed. There is another, coming back to why is there regulation, there is this other literature, which is this political economy of regulation, which says that actually, you know, it might be the case that this regulation is done for the benefit of the industry and not for the benefit of the consumer, that there is so-called regulatory capture, which comes here, the next one, which is that if we look at these industries that kind of like are heavily regulated, there is kind of like certain features which make it kind of like possible for those that should be regulated actually to kind of capture the regulator. And this actually would be a means for the industry players to kind of make it possible for new entrants and the competition to increase. And there is, you know, this talk about revolving doors, which means that the people that, you know, are regulators tend to turn up having jobs, highly paid jobs in the banks and vice versa. And there is some empirical evidence of this kind of private interests. So if there is this kind of like regulatory capture present and problems with such, then it could also, and if the outcome is that there is less competition, it's harder to come into that that industry, and there is abnormal profits to be kind of had because of the regulation and the regulatory capture, then that would also kind of mean that there is not the kind of emphasis on innovation. So the regulators would be very kind of against innovation and make it very difficult. Is this a case in medical insurance, medical industry? Yeah, it's quite hard to get the drug from the, you know, to be kind of accepted and developed. Maybe there's even in the food industry, there is a kind of like a lot of these kind of steps to get these kind of new innovative products accepted and to the market. So maybe there is kind of a similarity there between these heavily regulated industries. But if we look at the kind of regulation and innovation, the Lumpkin 2008 article kind of, he very nicely gives a kind of guidelines. How would the regulation of innovation in the financial services kind of be done that it would be kind of effective? So there is this kind of a call to have a kind of unbiased stance, and there has to be a kind of like tailor-made solutions, you know, to give a good good guidelines on how to protect consumers, how to kind of do the macroprudential framework in order that these new innovations wouldn't kind of cause a system-wide problems. How to kind of ensure the systemic stability of the system, and one of the new innovations that the regulation has done to promote innovation, which is a long sentence, is that they have actually opened up these kind of regulatory sandboxes, and these regulatory sandboxes are a way for regulator. These are, for example, in UK. They are thinking of having one in Finland, in Finva, where you could have a kind of lesser regulatory pressure on certain areas. You would have this kind of sandboxes where you could experiment before the kind of the full burden of regulation starts. So there is this kind of attempts also from the regulatory side to kind of help innovation and to help fintech firms to come up and not to be burdened by the regulation too much. I would like to notice that actually the European Supervisory Authority has encouraged to the development of fintechs, and they have these regulatory sandboxes, which I talked about. But there's also, for example, in Finland now, there's this fintech hotlines, help desks in the Financial Services Authority that the FIVA, that kind of you can call and ask. There is a clearer dialogue between these fintech players. Just to kind of give an idea that, for example, the industry organization Finanssi Ala doesn't accept these fintech firms as their members. So there is kind of like a clear division that if the regulatory authority wants to have a dialogue, it can't be through the industry organization. It has to be through the kind of some other means. And that's also one of the reasons why there is this discussion that should these fintechs be regulated like other financial service providers, or should the kind of like this regulation be somehow more technology based? So there is all these open questions that have not yet been kind of resolved by the regulators, and they are still kind of thinking about it. There is this kind of we talked a lot about Finland, the FIVA, and also the situation in Europe. But of course, there is this worldwide view, and as we saw that most of the activity is happening in Asia, then there is this kind of worldwide view of how kind of like what are the big questions in the worldwide space for regulation on the kind of these fintech firms, and the questions here are about, you can see there's like Chinese consumer credits, there's Chinese regulation of non-bank payment firms, and there's this GDPR in Europe, there's about the open banking restrictions, there's the a lot of different initiatives happening in different jurisdictions, but here you can also see that there is kind of a question still to be resolved in Asia, where the regulation usually has been a kind of more laxed, but it has also given room for more of this kind of like innovation than in like Europe and United States, where there has been kind of like more formal regulation already in place and really kind of enforced. I would like to end this regulatory part and this fintech part on the kind of funny note that Saunders actually has written a paper about that what is the future of banks? Will the banks actually be utilities? Like we have a kind of electric power company, we have a water company. Is this the future of banks? In a sense that if there is a lot of this regulation and this regulation hinders the kind of the risk taking, it hinders the innovation. So there is a tight jacket on what banks and financial service sector can do, then it could be that these banks will end up like quasi-public utilities, and this is something that now that we have this COVID crisis on our hands, and as I came back to the fact that that central bank has had to take a lot of these kind of roles that banks used to have, in a sense that kind of keeping the system afloat. Would this be actually the case that there is this kind of very dismal future for the banks as just utilities among others? But this is something I want to leave you to think, and I want to thank you for the possibility to tell about these new phenomena. As you can see, there's not a lot of like research done yet, except for example these cryptocurrencies. So most of this research is still kind of nascent, and that's why there has to be this kind of like reference to a certain kind of you know, consulting papers and overviews and by regulatory authorities. But I hope this gave you an idea what is happening in the market, what is the change, what are the kind of challenges, what are the possibilities, how it has evolved to more kind of research and development led activity, and what is there kind of like from the regulatory perspective to be kind of expected in the future. So Juha-Pekka, thanks for letting me share these thoughts with you, and you said you wanted to have 5 minutes for questions, and I think it's 5 minutes left.
Yeah, you are very exact on this. So thanks very much, Olli-Pekka. It was a nice presentation, and it covered various things that we have actually been already discussing, but from a different point of view. Now we have actually here some questions. So first of all, Evita is now actually asking two questions.
Mm-hmm.
First one is about the smart contract technologies that you discussed. Yes. About. Do you know if any significant players or like big banks have made any initiatives to adapt these smart technologies, or if you have to guess, when would this technology be in wide use?
Okay. Thanks for that question. It's very interesting because these smart contracts, when they were formed on top of this kind of blockchain technology, I think that this Ethereum became like 2004 or 5. You know, that was like the first kind of that incorporated this possibility to kind of write software-based contracts that could be verified and have them somehow automated. A lot of interest was kind of seen and was generated because it was thought that that could be actually all these kind of, you know, mortgage types things could be, that the loan contracts could be transferred and everything. The backslash came when this Ethereum contracts actually were hacked. So there was this case where they saw they saw that there was vulnerabilities in them. So that a little bit got them back. But I know that there is these consortiums, like I think R3 is one. And where there is a banks and insurance companies, then there is this Linux-based Hyperledger consortium, which also has financial sector players, and they are kind of like partly open, partly closed networks where they try to kind of develop these technologies further and these smart contracts alongside. However, there's thing that I forgot to mention is that if you have this blockchain and the contracts that are built on top of it, I mentioned that the problems with the blockchain is that it's very computed. It takes a lot of computer resources. It's very computing intensive, and it's slow. But that's only in the case if you have it open for everybody. If you have non-verified users in the system, then you have to have this very tight kind of security and encryption technology. But if it's like a system that has only a recognizable number of players, let's say that 10 or 20 banks make an alliance and they just make this blockchain technology that is usable for themselves, then this verification and encryption requirements go down a lot, because you don't need to kind of proof it for the kind of non-recognized third party. And then it becomes more efficient. And I think that this is the way that they have started to develop these, is that they will have them kind of closed systems. And when they have, can I just, when they have done this, it becomes like, it's, you can't kind of really know what's happening. That's then research and development within those consortiums. So there is such, and but I don't know what the situation is at the moment.
Yeah, okay, that was very thorough answer. But Evita is also asking an interesting question about the, when you mentioned in the first lecture that the there is an optimal size for the financial sector. Yeah. And you say in the slides that fast growth in the finance sector detracts growth of productivity in the real sector.
Yeah.
So she wants to know that, can you say that for maximum economic growth in the whole economy, the finance sector should grow slower or in the same phase as the economy, if we assume that the real productivity growth is the one that drives the economic growth?
That's a really good question.
this is really nice question.
Yeah, this is like, you know that you're gonna get A from this course by just asking that question.
Thank you.
So the discussion of about the optimal size of the financial services sector started in the United States, where that sector was growing very rapidly. This was before the financial crisis of 2008. So that a lot of talent and you know, a lot of this kind of like value addition that turned out to be then kind of like problematic was generated there. And I think that the question, Juha-Petta, you might be a better, you know, to answer this, but I would say that, you know, my guess would be that if there is a kind of a fixed ratio of like financial services given kind of like, you know, real stuff the economy do, then it should kind of move apart in the same speed, the growth. But and then if it's kind of like grows faster, then it kind of diverges stuff from the kind of real side. But how do you see, Juha-Petta?
Well, I see this in a way that you have to also take into account that what is the role of market-based funding in the economy compared to these financial intermediaries' role. So the banking sector role might be clearly different in some countries that are growing at a different stage compared to some other countries. So the role of banking sector in those might be clearly different. So and there's obviously some kind of long-term steady state value for the growth of financial sector in general. When it might be that there comes a stage when the growth in the financial sector is not about increasing the real growth in the economy, but it's all more like about speculation in the financial markets. So if the funding is not getting transmitted to the best productive real investment projects, so then it's not enhancing real growth anymore. So it's very much about also the role of financial intermediary sector, the banking sector, and about for the role of stock markets, for example. There's this wide literature about the connections between finance growth and real economic growth that is discussing about these things. But this is very good question, actually. Yeah, this shows somehow that you have got the general idea of the course. Quite well. But there are no other questions. Is there anyone that would like to ask something else? I have one question to Olli-Pekka about the regulation, because we are now ending the lectures to the perhaps the most one of the most important issues or themes at the moment. It's about the regulation of the standard banking sector against the regulation of these new fintechs and so on.
Yeah.
So now that we know that we have these Basel III requirements going on about liquidity ratios and so on, and the liquidity is huge at the standard banking sector at the moment, as we know.
Yeah.
So do you think that it's now, we are now actually in a situation in regarding the regulation of the traditional banking sector, that it's already too much? It's hindering actually the real economic growth, or is it hindering the, or is it stopping the positive development of the profitability of the banking sector? Are we doing too much regulation at the moment? What is your personal opinion on this?
Well, I think that, I don't know, is this the answer to your question, but I think that this regulation at the moment has been kind of sidelined because of this COVID crisis and the need to increase liquidity. As you know, there was like, you know, relaxation of a lot of these kind of regulations when the COVID hit. About the kind of, you know, the capital requirements and this. And I don't know whether the kind of, there has been an evaluation whether this has been a good or bad thing because of, you know, as you said, we are flushed with liquidity and the banks have been quite, I think, successful in kind of adapting to this new environment. Has it just led to kind of increase in the value of an assets and not kind of like really transmitting them to the productive economy and making, you know, the economy kind of sustain the COVID? I don't know, but what's your view? What do you think?
Well, I think that we might have some kind of this kind of a optimal stage also for the regulation, that at some point it's too much. So the banking sector stops working following its fundamental idea that it should be transmitting the funding from the excess sector to the ones in need for funding. So there might be some kind of, but now, as you mentioned, the situation with the COVID, it's now sort of it makes everything a mess at the moment, because the things are completely based on the huge extension of the central bank balance sheets. So everything is dependent on that. And if the central bank stop doing that, and at the moment it transforms into the most liquid forms of assets in the banking sector, but it's not being transformed to the real sector because there's no demand for investments and there's no demand for goods and there's no real role for increasing real investments. So obviously, we are now living perhaps 1 or 2 years period of completely extraordinary things in terms of financial intermediation too. It's not working in the normal way.
Yeah.
But I have done some research about the profitability of banks during the negative interest rates era, and I noticed some alarming results from the Finnish banking sector. The Finnish OP banking group actually started to suffer in terms of all the profitability measures already from the beginning of 2017. And we had no idea about the COVID at that time. So the negative interest rates are not a good thing for actually the normal banking. That's my humble view of on these things based on just the data from the Finnish OP Max. And it would be interesting to do this kind of analysis also for the European banking sector. But one of the important things that I also wanted to ask you about is this, that non-regulation of the fintechs, actually.
Yeah.
So I think that, for example, in China, we had actually the same report from the Cambridge Center for Alternative Finance earlier in this course. And we have observed already that the amount of fintechs in China, or the volumes of transmission of funds through this new forms of finance, it collapsed actually last year. And one of the reasons for the increased regulation, the main reason actually was the increased regulation. And the Finnish crowdfunding firms have been already regulated from, was it 2016 or 17, like based on the Finnish authorities. Yeah. So is it something that we should actually take a very close look that what is the optimal degree of regulating the new fintech firms if we want to enhance those, actually, because the standard banking sector is would very much, like you mentioned here, that they would very much like to make the most of the new advantages in that sector, actually. They want to use those things, yeah, these technologies. So is it actually something that we should put much more effort on these, for example, these sandboxes? They are, yeah, they are very nice thing, actually. So do you are you in favor of these kind of ideas, that there actually should be a perhaps a little lighter, not so strong regulation on these right from the beginning, these new fintechs?
Yeah, I think that the regulation is important, but I also think that these kind of regulatory innovations, in the sense that sandboxes, you know, all other type of things that make the burden kind of more manageable for this kind of small scale, you know, innovative firms, is beneficial. But I understand that that there is a kind of like a lot of kind of thinking within the regulatory authorities how to kind of encompass this. But as it is such a new phenomena, and it has this technology side, which is also kind of a little bit something that the kind of ordinary, you know, financial services authorities, regulators have not kind of been that close into, poses a kind of, you know, problems to kind of like find the good way forward. But I agree with you, Juha-Pekka, definitely this.
Yeah, okay. Thanks. So I think we are already over time, clearly, but usually it goes like this when we have interesting discussions. you gave a very nice presentation. I'm very, very grateful to you. So thanks very much about this. And if there are no other questions, then I would very much like to thank you, Olli-Pekka, for giving these lectures, and very much hope to have you here next year too.
Okay. Yeah, let's. Thank you very much. It was so nice to be able to present. I'm really a little bit sad that we didn't have that much discussion, because of these Teams and this Zoom type of environment doesn't encourage discussion. But if you have any questions and you would have wanted to ask and you didn't have a kind of time or you didn't press the button, please send me an email. I'm more than happy to answer them. And thanks, Juha-Pekka, for everything. And see you next year then.
Yeah, see you next year then. And for the students, I would like to actually end up by noting that take a look at the Moodle latest information announcements there. There's important information about the exam. And for example, this material given by Olli-Pekka is going to be definitely one part of that. Okay.
Okay.
See you all. Have a nice weekend.
Same to everybody. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.